Hello and welcome to the Providence College Podcast. I'm your host, Liz Kay, and I'm joined by producer Chris Judge of the class of 2005. Here on the Providence College Podcast, we bring you interesting stories from the Fryer family. This week, we're talking with Richie Kless, who spent most of his adult life, minus 1 year, as a student, faculty, or staff member at Providence College. The Brooklyn native and social work major graduated from PC in 1974, where he was a member of the Friars Club, was captain of the club football team, and met his wife, Terry, a member of the class of 1976. Richie came back for a master's degree in theology in 1978, as well as a degree in fire science in 1982, from what is now known as the School of Continuing Education. He also taught theology for continuing ed, and later returned to work in student affairs while also serving as the advisor of the Cowl, PC student newspaper, the Veritas, the yearbook, and also Shepherd for many years. Richie, it's so great to have you back on campus. How has retirement been treating you so far?
It's been wonderful, and I have been living a full-speed life, mostly assisting, helping, and involved with family, which was the big beckoning of why I retired. It's just been great. I miss my friends here at PC, but I'm not too far, as you know, and here I am. So all in all, pandemic aside, we're doing great. We're doing great and adjusting marvelously.
So tell us, let's start at the very beginning. What brought you to PC initially, and what are some of your favorite memories from undergrad?
Well, my mother's cousin was a Dominican priest, Father James Quigley, and he was chaplain here at PC in the early 70s. And I also was pretty good track athlete in Brooklyn, New York, and had won the New York City or Brooklyn Queens hurdling champion, and among other events. So I was a pretty good athlete. And I received a letter from the track coach to come, and they gave me a partial scholarship. So I actually came here to run at PC. But when I got up here, there was no track and there was no hurdles. And I was thinking, what am I going to jump garbage cans? You know, so like they tried to make me a half miler, but I was really a sprinter. But then I discovered that PC had a football team. It was club, but that was my number one passion. And so I ran for 2 years, but I played football here for four. And I was a social work major. The years of the 70s, growing up in the 60s, was a very tumultuous, you know, Vietnam, civil rights era. And many of us chose social work as we were the generation that was going to change things. You know, we had John Kennedy telling us, ask what you know, your country could do for you. What could you do for your country? And, you know, the Peace Corps and all these volunteer endeavors exploded. And I think PC was very reflective of the nation at the time. So that was my interest. I always had a deep interest in working with people. I can remember my guidance counselor in high school looked at my one of those personality and career profile examinations, or, you know, self-examination that you do, and he said, well, you don't want to become an accountant. And I said, oh, no, my math was not my subject. But things like recreation director, social worker, teacher, all were heavy in my profile. And PC had a great social work department, and that's what I gravitated to.
But it was that athletic connection that
yeah,
drew you.
Yeah, that was a, you know, and it's funny, I talked to some modern day athletes, you know, I'm collegiate athletes today, where, you know, they have a campus visit, they, you know, they give in the tours, you just, my letter was as big as a 3x5 index card, you know, and then you looked up in the Barron's book what the profile of Providence College was. No glossy pictures, no CD, no website to go to. It was like, okay. And when I got here and saw the city of Providence, having grown up in Brooklyn and New York City my whole life, I was like, that can't be a city because that my neighborhood is bigger than this. But I fell in love with Rhode Island. I really did, along with falling in love with Terry. But that's down the road, you know. Absolutely found that my years as an undergraduate, just self-discovery, more about myself. I was very immature. I was probably the youngest of my class in the class of 74. I was a late baby. So I was December 26th was my birthday. And being the youngest of four children in Brooklyn, New York, you know, I should have been held back. But I think my mother was kind of crazy of me, like, get this kid into school, you know. And as a result, I was only 17 years of age in my freshman year. And I looking back, I was very immature. But I had a happenstance, wonderful serendipitous moment with Father Walter Heath, who was the director of Residence Life. And he was the combination dean of discipline, if you were. We didn't have one, but he ruled the roost. And I had some great encounters with him. And he, along with a number of other professors and priests on campus, some who were my professors and some who I just knew casually outside the classroom, because in those early days, you know, most priests lived on the floors with all the students. So every dorm had four or five, maybe eight priests living, some two on a floor, some one. And they became your friends. I mean, drinking age was 18, so, you know, they'd come by and have a beer with you because you usually had a couple of beers in the refrigerator or things like that. And it was a just different atmosphere and more home free, but you got to know a lot of the friars, the Dominican friars, as personal friends. And they had deep influence in me, and their intellect I was in awe of. I really was. I wasn't an all-star student by any means. But I think my encounters with many of the Dominicans over the years, especially in those early undergraduate years, whetted my appetite to say, you're here to learn. And it was mostly learning about myself that I think transfigured myself to be the student affairs professional I was going to become down the road. It really was. And I used that experience in my years in residence life as the assistant director of residence life and speaking with young people who were making the adjustments of living on campus, and then in the discipline office too, or the community standards office, about, you know, you can leave Providence College with a degree in marketing, with a degree in accounting, with a degree in bioscience, and whether you're a 4.0 or you're a 2.5 student, if you haven't learned about yourself during the 4 years of your matriculation here, two things have happened. The first is that you spent a lot of money on a fantastic education, and that's terrible because you could have spent the money elsewhere. The second is worse. You failed yourself. You might be a 4.0 biochem major, but you haven't discovered much about yourself.
You haven't learned the most important lesson.
And that's the big thing, I think, is the forte and the hallmark of a Providence College education, and why our students back in the 70s and 40s and even in present day love this place. And the bonds of friendship and the meaning that takes place to them is all about that they discover themselves in ways that they may not have before. So I'm looking back. Sorry for going astray here, but that's what I'm known for. is that my own journey of self-discovery and enlightenment, I guess, helped me in my later years working with students. And I loved it, loved it.
Well, and I think you mentioned Father Heath, and there were so many generations of PC students who would have a similar feeling about their relationship with Father Heath and
oh, yeah.
the other Dominicans that were here. I wonder, was it the close relationships you had with those Dominicans that inspired you to go on for your master's in theology?
Yes, it was, but there was a bit of an episode in my sophomore year where, I'm not proud of this, but it happened. I was probably the last kid of the 60s and the early 70s not to try marijuana. And I mean it. I mean, even when I went back to Brooklyn, New York, like everybody, all my friends, would, and I was just like, no, I just don't want to put smoke into my lungs. It's not a good thing, you know. And but one time I tried it and I fell in love with it. And but one night I had taken some stuff that had obviously, I didn't know it at the time, been laced with some LSD. And that was the last time I've had it. But I went through a deep period of, I guess, paranoia. But during that time period, I did a lot of reading philosophy and theology. And I had a fascination with the afterlife. Like, you know, is there truly a soul? And in speaking and having that as a nagging question, you know, I grew up a Catholic. I was from kindergarten on. I was a completely 100% unadulterated Catholic educated student. You know, I had the Sisters of St. Joseph. I had the Christian Brothers in high school. And here I was at a Dominican college. And but still wanted a much more in-depth aspect of the spirit life. And I started reading again on my own. This was outside the classroom, philosophy and theology books. And for the first time, I read the four Gospels. And I started a deeper look at the person Jesus. And I would grab a Dominican anytime I could to have a discussion with them. I remember Father Tom Coscorn, who was one of the most brilliant men I've ever encountered. And as you know, a lot of the Dominicans are very brilliant men, but he was, I would say, an elite. And he had taught the Arts Honors people, which I was furthest from. But I got to know Father Tom casually going to daily mass, and we would often have lunch together. And I thought it was just awesome that this guy who taught all the true scholars on campus was interested in speaking with me. And that just whetted my appetite for knowing a little bit more about the person Jesus. And it's to this day, if there's a book about Jesus, I'm reading it. But again, it was all about how could my knowledge about theology and Jesus and the church, and I wasn't even committed to the church at the time. I was just in this like searching web out there and like, oh, you know, not too sure I wanted to be a Catholic anymore, you know, just, but, you know, I'm gonna find out about Jesus. And when I did, it hook, line, and sinker. It was like, yep, he's my guy and he's my salvation, and for a lot of reasons, but that's a whole nother. But it's the driving force in everything I've done.
And so that led you master's in theology. Like, did you knew that right out of undergrad? You were going
there? This is where I sometimes wish my wife was here, because when I was dating Terry was 2 years behind me, but I got to, we were dating when I was in grad school, and her dad used to say, you know, Terry, I think you're taking a vocation away from the priesthood by dating this young man. And, you know, the more I was weighing that, the more I was falling in love with Terry. So I never had any issue with it, to be honest with you. Neither did she. She just shrugged her shoulders. But it was a thought that I might go into teaching. And that's what I did. But I had taken, while I was an undergrad, a number of fire department exams. Both my brother and I, we were only 14 months apart from the time we were little kids. We just wanted to be in the fire service because we had a couple of uncles and cousins of my both my mom and my dad's side in New York City that was very prominent in our you know, fixture as little boys, you know, go and visit the firehouse. So I had always taken exams for that. I did it in New York City, and I also took a number of the exams around here in the state of Rhode Island as a fallback, you know. And I did get on the Providence Fire Department, and I was very fortunate too, because it was I just got, Terry and I had just got married, and you know, it was a good paying job. And I went, decided, well, I heard about the state of Rhode Island gave an incentive for Rhode Island firefighters if you got a degree in fire science. And there was one being offered at Community College of Rhode Island, and there was one being offered at Providence College, and there was no doubt where I was going to go. Well, I went into the School of Continuing Education to sign up for my fire science courses. And Dr. Roger Pearson, who was then the dean of the School of Continuing Education, said, "Hey, class, come here. I need you." And I was like, "What do you need me for?" And he just knew me socially, and a great Hemingway scholar in his own right, wonderful guy. But he said, "Hey, you got your master's in theology, right?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." He said, "Did you ever think about teaching here?" And I was like, "Where?" And he said, in the School of Continuing Education. I said, "Oh, yeah, that'd be great someday." You know, he goes, "Really?" He goes, "Well, I might call you." So the next day he called me and he said, "Hey, can you get in here?" And it turned out that he had a, I think it was Father Detling or somebody else who was scheduled to teach a course and got summoned to go to Rome. He said, "I need you." And I said, "Well, when?" He goes, "Well, here's the syllabus. Next week you start." And I did that, and that was in 1980. And so 41 years of teaching theology in the night school worked out great.
So let's just clarify for our listeners if they don't understand. Yeah. So you had come in to sign up for your fire science classes, and you also got pulled in to teach. So one day a week, was it Monday nights you were teaching?
Usually Monday, and I think maybe I started Wednesdays, depending on those, the first, because it took me 2.5 years to get my fire science degree.
Because probably because you were teaching the other days of the week.
Right,
so you were a professor one day,
yep,
a few days of the week, but
and
you were a student.
And the others. And that was, for a young guy, it was intimidating. But again, I remember going to visit Father Keegan, Terry Keegan, and Father Giles Dimmick, who I was friends with, who were, you know, somewhat mentors of mine, and asked them about, you know, teaching college and all that, and thought, you know, who am I to do this? But they said, you know, "Hey, well, we trained you, so you're good." And and really, I look back at some of the brilliant theology professors that we had that would come here during the summers, John Bright and Ray Brown, who were just recognized world-renowned biblical scholars, and I had them. So it was great. The great Dominican Thomas Aquinas Collins, how you like that name, right? He was a biblical scholar, and he was one of the editors of what is still used today, the Jerome Biblical Commentary, and it was because of his forte that he was able to attract some of these wonderful scholars from around the world. So
people wanted to work for him.
It really was. It was great. So I had that as, and that was a big confidence booster for me.
So Richie, there's a somewhat infamous website known as ratemyprofessor.com. Yeah. And I'd like to read to you some of the reviews of your courses, if that could you take a minute to do that. Despite my indifference towards the subject, I find myself doing the readings, despite being optional. He's so energetic and animated, and he really gets you thinking about the person of Jesus in a way that you don't normally. What you will get from the class cannot be measured by the grade. So three different students over a decade responded that way. So I should hope, I don't know how you feel about that, but I guess.
Well, you just put a tear in my eye, but no, I didn't know that. So it's funny. I once had to give a talk to the students of who were graduating SCE. And each year they ask one of the professors, although I'm not a professor in rank, visiting lecturer, I guess, was my title. And as they introduced me, one of the students, I think it was Ann Nagel, who said, you know, Richie's class has been described at the crossroads of Margaritaville and Catholicism. And I am very animated in the classroom, and I do have always done my best, whether I was teaching a course on the church or teaching a course about Jesus, Christology class. I always would try to get students to place themselves in the scene of any gospel story that they were reading. Whether that would be the person who Jesus is dialoguing with, or whether that be someone on the side watching Jesus dialogue with this guy. You're a shepherd and he's talking to some fisherman. You're like, hey, I'm glad he's not picking on me. This is great. You know, I'll make that fisherman look like an idiot, you know? But to be listening to the words that he would be saying. And I said, you know, when you do that, you start to see the flesh and blood of Jesus. And by that, it leads us into this absolutely awesome, excuse my language here, freaking astounding mystery, but wonderment of the incarnation. That to think the being who created all that we understand and know and are unveiling, even the universe, has taken on flesh. And I just that we're redeemed by not a God up there, but someone who walked around like us. And it's in our humanity that we see the divine. And that spark has made me want to always do everything I can to animate the divine spark in other people. I don't know if I'm explaining that well, but that's been a big influence on the way I teach and the methodology that I had. It's almost like drama.
Richie, I think it's clear, and just again, for our listeners who may not understand this or know this, but in the School of Continuing Education, you're teaching students, adult learners from all walks of life.
Oh, yeah.
And unlike the students in the undergraduate school, many of them, I would say probably many of more, certainly more than the undergraduate school, they are not cradle Catholics. You know,
no.
I mean, certainly the population of cradle Catholics, you know, people who come in to undergraduate school, you know, the number of Catholics is declining, but certainly the population in the among the adult learners is higher. And so how do you approach that challenge? I mean, it is an opportunity for evangelism among a population that is so different, than many others. And I feel like especially today we're so siloed and we often talk to people who agree with us and think and have very similar backgrounds to us, that the work that you do in SEE through these courses is an amazing opportunity.
It is, and deeply humbling, because I'll tell you, when you're teaching adults, what we call a non-traditional student, all right, these are people, it's a mom who started her freshman year, whether it was at PC or Villanova or some other institution. You know, she's got two kids now. Her husband was the breadwinner, but you know, she always made a vow to herself or somebody, I'm going to get my degree. And they come back to school. I haven't been in a classroom in 15 years. Where you get the veteran, I got to tell you, I sometimes choke up when I think the many veterans that I had, men and women, who were sadly, you know, but that was the reality of our last 20 years in Iraq, Iran, or Afghanistan. And they went through some traumatic events, but they came back and like, I'm going to get my college degree. And the key that I found in my success was A, I was humbled to have them, and B, to meet them where they were at. And by doing so, I had great respect for that mom who was coming back, but I know that she had to go back to a litter of puppies and two kids, one who's, you know, in the sixth grade and the other's in the third grade and sniffling and husband's away, that whole dynamic. In my early years, we used to have a lot more undergrads who would be taking classes at night. And that would be very stimulating for discussions, because we would bring up a topic, let's say, and some of the traditional student, you know, the 18 to 22 year old is in my class, and they would have this remark, and then I could turn to say a mother or a dad in the class and say, well, what do you think, you know? Because the student will say, well, you know, my mother used to tell me when I was growing up that, you know, if you do this and you know, I was Catholic, blah, 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 blah. And I said, well, what do you think? I didn't ask you about your mother. She's not in the class. What are you thinking about? And you get this cross-generational aspect. So I think the respect was that the younger people would look to, oh my God, I'm taking a class with someone who is my mom's age, and boy, they think similar or dissimilar, but it would provoke thought, but it would also be very affirming to the non-traditional learner, the more adult, and that they would say, wow, this is okay, you know, and make them feel comfortable that I'm just as valid a student as that 19 or 20 year old young lady who's in class with me, you know. So it was good. I loved it. I could have my work as a full-time student affairs professional. I mean, we haven't talked about that yet, but when you're in residence life, you are pretty much going from crisis to crisis to crisis, whether it's a broken lamp in a student's room or two roommates that have had a fight or you name it. I mean, you see every aspect of kids living on campus, who was drunk the night before, who got sick, who got transported to the hospital, blah, blah. And I'd be, you're exhausted at the end of the day. But I have to tell you, I stepped in that classroom, I looked forward to it. There was never a time when I was going, I'm like, oh man, I got to teach tonight. Never thought that. I'm like, oh man, this is great. I got to teach tonight. That's how I felt. It was great. It was wonderful.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. There are plenty of difficult jobs in higher education, but community standards, where you worked for many years, and residence life, where you worked for many years, you know, student conduct and discipline, and you know, it's the top of the list of tough jobs in higher ed, without a doubt. What are some of the things you feel? What are some of the things you feel like you learned in those years, and working with students, but not only students, you know, their families and the neighbors, the neighbors of Providence College.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me just start by saying how I got involved coming back to work full time for the college. This is apart from teaching, right? I had a number of people who I had in my classes at night who were employees of the college. Specifically, Mike Barry and Mark Raposa were two guys, along with a number of administrative assistants. And Mark Raposa had heard that I had was leaving the fire service. And he said, you would be absolutely fantastic in residence life. We need you, you know. So I applied and interviewed with Father Joe Tortorici. And it was, there were a lot of applicants, but I got the job. And so I was the associate director of residence life for what they call operations. So I had to deal with all the physical attributes, worked with physical plant of trying to make sure students' rooms and the settings and the buildings were running and all that. And that was great. But that's where you got to meet and deal with many parents calling in, because it was the era of the helicopter parent, you know, coming in. And you diplomatically tried your best to say, you know, okay, I'm dealing with your 19-year-old son and you're calling from Maryland. Why isn't your son here talking to me about this situation? And well, he's busy, you know, like, and what do you do? Well, I'm working too. But well, so the whole thing about this idea of let's try to have your son come in and speak with me first. And if you're not satisfied, how about then we'll have a talk? And it's just, and I would do that respectfully because I meant it. It's like, well, he's here to get an education, but not just in the classroom. We want him to develop the skills to be able to talk to other adults and say, I have a problem in my room. I'm not calling mommy all the time, you know? And that generally would work out. But, you know, working in residence life, as I mentioned before, you saw the good, the bad, and the ugly. One of the things that I think my experience over the many years offered me was the perspective of seeing some of these absolutely wonderful, dynamic, brilliant students in ways that their professors didn't. Father Card was the he was one of my directors of residence life when he first came to the college. And we went to a seminar, I think it was when we first started doing evaluations and studies of our own students. We had never done that before. And we were sitting in the back of the classroom. It was mostly all professors at the session. And Dr. Ray Sickinger was given the graphics of, you know, PC students study X amount of hours and they do this and they do this and then and do this on the weekends. And one of the professors down below said, well, that's impossible. I give 18 hours of reading a week, you know, and Father Sicard and I were like, well, you should come into the dorms at 10 o'clock on a Friday night and see that they're not reading your, you know, Beowulf at, for the 18 hours that you may have assigned. But, it, you know, it's the blend of the academic pursuits and, you know, you talk about discipline. I was in residence life for many years and we call the discipline office, it's emerged over the years from discipline to student conduct to now it's called community standards. But whatever it was called, if you were, you know, you're in trouble, it's like, okay, you gotta go talk to someone. And I remember when I was in residence life, the director of, was in judicial affairs, Ron Kelly used to say, you got to do this job. You got to come over here. You could be great at that. And I'm like, I don't want anything to do with that stuff. Like, I have enough trouble in my life right now. And, you know, when it got to a point where there were two women who had the job, Maureen Quinlan and Emily D'Orsi, they were the two ladies who were running the office, and they both had to leave simultaneously for completely different reasons. I was asked to go up there and put my finger in the dike, so to speak, and hold the fort. So I was the acting director for a year and a half while I was also doing the off-campus living stuff. So, but I saw students at their most vulnerable. Like, they're coming in and speaking to you about probably, and this runs the whole gamut of, you know, I got transported to go to a hospital because I drank too much. I punched somebody, I punched a hole in a wall. I did this from, you know, some really tough cases of intimacy that, you know, went not in a good way, to be talking about delicate subjects. And students are opening up their hearts and their minds to you. It's a very humbling experience. And I never thought that it would evolve the way it did. And, you know, it turned out I was okay with that and stayed there and got a lot of good accolades about my work in that area. But again, it was humbling. And, you know, I likened it to almost like you're seeing, it's like someone going to confession, you know, it was like, and to look at that, to give an example, I know, you know, I can never talk about a case, but I remember one professor coming to me who had heard about his star pupil was in trouble and saying, "This can't be." And, you know, all I could say is, I can't talk to you about the case, but in my head, the reality is it can be. That star pupil sitting in your classroom was involved in an incident that was not reflective of her, but she or he did something that we have to address. And it becomes delicate, but again, the respect for the student, the respect for why they're here. We in the people I've worked with in the many years, both in residence life and in community standards, we never felt it was a philosophy, and this goes to me back to the Dominicans. We never felt that, you know, and this is you hear this all the time. You got to set an example. You know you got to take this kid and you got to throw him out and you got to do this and that. And that's not our role. We're in the education business. So, you know, it's not the penal code. It's student conduct. So the conversations would like, okay, how did that behavior last Friday night, how does that fit in with your pursuit of your degree here in 4 years? And you get the students to reflect on that. And you get the students to say, man, I just, oh, that's not me. It's not who I want to be. And I said, well, it certainly doesn't fit into your matriculation plans here, because if this is the way you're going, you're not ready for college, or you know, or you need a timeout, you know. And sometimes students would take a semester off or things, depend on the severity of things, you know. A lot of that, I noticed over the years, there were changes from behaviors of, you know, I just think of the different generations. I always think of undergraduate, a generation is 5 years, because if you're a senior and I'm a freshman, I kind of recall over the years, like, oh yeah, that girl, she was in my class, she was a senior, I remember her. But if you go 5 years, there's no connection. So I think of over, and this is just my mind, every 5 years is a new generation of students, you know, to the college, the institution. I'm not talking about out there in the general public of a 20-year generation, but things change. And the evolution of the behaviors and the responsibilities, I often run into alums And they're like, so how is it? How is it? You know, how are things? It's different, you know, and it is and it isn't. The students, I think, are brighter. Well, you know, I know a lot of people here work at PC who've been here as many years as I had, and you know, I couldn't get in here today, you know? I mean, the SAT scores, this, that, and the other thing. It's the profile of our student academically is just skyrocketed, which is wonderful. But I'd say the big difference is the delayed responsibility, and that's just generational. It's just, you know, I can remember one of the hall directors I worked with that in residence life said, you know, Richie, he goes, I just don't understand these parents. You know, they're crying, they're letting the kids go. He goes, when I went to college, my mother didn't even get off the couch. You know, she was like, yeah, I'll see you at Christmas. You know, I'll see you later. And that was, and now it's, you know, the daily ties of you know, texting back home every day or getting on, you know, a FaceTime or a Zoom call daily keeps that home connection. So it's just a different era, but the students are dedicated to each other. I still see the one thing, the dynamic that I see runs through Providence College is that the students love each other. They love this institution. And that's what has never changed since my day and the days of, if you talk, I literally ran in. I was in Stop and Shop yesterday, and a guy came up to me, goes, hey, Richie. And he's a neighbor, he's a fellow parishioner. And his class had, over this past weekend, their 50th anniversary. And he's a lawyer, and he hadn't been back to campus, and he was astounded. And he goes, and I sat and I talked to three students. It was like, oh my gosh, I felt I was back in the dorms. And I said, oh yeah. That's the dynamism that is PC education, the love of the friendships, the people that you met, your roommates, all those people, you just cherish them. And that today is still going on.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Amen.
So Richie, it has been so good to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
20 more hours we could talk about, but I've enjoyed this. Thanks so much.
Subscribe to the Providence College podcast in all the usual places, including iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify, as well as your smart speaker. If you like what you hear, please review and share with others. Thanks for listening, and go Friars.